If you've always wanted to learn the Artist Low Comedy method of improv from me, Jimmy Corrine, I got some good news for you. I'll be offering an Art of Slow Comedy Summer Weekend Intensive online the weekend of Saturday, July 18th, and Sunday, July 19th. For more information, go to my website at jimmycorrine.com. That's jimmycorrine.com.
Jimmy, Jimmy Corrine, Jimmy Corrine's a nerd. Jimmy Corrine's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corrine's a nerd. Oh,
hey, everybody. This is Jimmy Corrine, host of Improv Nerd, and you're listening to episode 267. Our guest today is Rick Walker. He has been a part of Improvised Shakespeare for the last 15 years, where he is not only a performer, but he is also the director of the Chicago cast. He is a professor at Columbia College, where he teaches improv, sketch, and stand-up. We talk to him about Improvised Shakespeare, why emotions are our best friends when we're improvising, and his thoughts on diversity in improv. Before we get to the interview, this is the part of the podcast where I usually tell a story from my life. But with what is going on in this country, with the racial unrest and the protesting, telling a stupid story from my life, it just doesn't feel right. Now, the conversation has shifted. We are talking about systemic racism in this country on all levels. And that conversation includes the improv community. I'm somebody of white entitlement, white privilege, who was clueless. I mean, I couldn't even admit that I had it. And now I'm slowly waking up to what it really means. So the best thing that I can do is to listen more and to learn more so I can do better in the future. And one thing that's become very clear to me is I'd like to do a better job of including more diverse voices on this podcast. Here's episode 267, the Rick Walker episode. Enjoy. Rick Walker, thank you for being my guest on Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Corrine, thank you for having me here. It was an honor.
So let's go back to 1986. You're living in Columbus, Ohio, and you're getting a BFA in acting there at Wright.
Wright State, yeah. I
went to Wright State. Mm-hmm. And how does this guy who wants to be a serious actor end up getting into improv?
Well, I think it was like the summer of, I'm not really sure of the timeline, but maybe the summer of 85, and I came home for a visit, and or 86, it was like the summer of 86, and my best friend from high school, Mike Loftus, and my brother, Kenny Walker, were doing open mic nights. You know, they had been doing it over the school year, and so I came home from Dayton to Columbus for the summer, and I was like, well, I'm as funny as they are. I'm real competitive. I'm going to get on stage and do some open mic night stuff. So I started doing open mics with them. And I think I won my first open mic the first night. So, because I just wrote a monologue based on a character that I had done in a play and just wrote a comedic monologue. And it was different. It was more like solo sketch. I'd never heard of solo sketch at that point, but it was more like that. And I loved it. It was so fun. And it was also so scary, you know, that, writing it myself and my own sense of humor being on display, it seemed riskier than any other performance that I had done. Because, you know, in a play, you rehearse forever. And by the time you get to opening night, you might have a little bit of opening night jitters. But, you know, you're confident. You know what you're going to do. So you're not really nervous. So it was very different doing stand-up. And then we started to get a lot of heat, you know, these young guys that were doing stand-up and started getting some attention. This woman, there was a very short-lived comedy sports in Columbus. I think it was like a couple months long it lasted. And the woman that was in charge of that, this woman named Lisa Phillips, took some of the people that she liked working with in that comedy sports, and then some of us improvisers, and she put us together on an improv team, and we called it Midwest Comedy Tool and Die.
And you guys had no formal training. You guys were literally improvising improv, right? You were making it up as you were going along.
Yeah, like I think Lisa had gotten a little training from Dick Chudnow, when that comedy sports opened up. But so she knew a little bit. We didn't know anything, and we didn't listen to Lisa very well. And we just started, we would start making up our own forms based on like 70s talk shows, like To Tell the Truth or game shows or whatever. Just like goofing off, having fun, making each other laugh.
And then you kind of discovered like agreement and other rules by accident.
Yeah. We would like sit around and talk improv for hours after a show. So we would do like a 45-minute set at first. The bar that we were performing in was called the Comedy Club in a Ramada Inn in Columbus. And
is it still there?
No.
Because it should be like they should make it a landmark.
Yeah, right. We would sit, so they would give us two pitchers of beer. That was our pay. So we would sit around and drink those pitchers and talk about the show, like what worked, what didn't work, why didn't it work, why didn't it work better, why aren't you being funny, why aren't you wearing jeans without holes in them, you know.
Why haven't you taken a shower? Where am I going to crash tonight?
Exactly. And then we'd buy more pitchers and hang out longer and just talk. So, yeah, we kind of figured out a few things about improv sort of organically. Like if we agree at the top of the scene, because we were doing only short form. So if we agree really quickly, we can just, you know, the audience laughs more.
So then, so in 1993, you move to Chicago and you start you wait 9 years before you start taking any sort of improv classes or get involved in improv. And the first place you decide to study is comedy sports.
Yep.
Now, with all the places you could study in Chicago, how did you decide on comedy sports?
Do you know Joe James?
Yes.
So Joe was artistic director at comedy sports at the time. And I knew Joe from undergrad, and our paths would cross every once in a while. But we had like the same group of friends in college. He was just a few years ahead. And so he was at like that end of the friend group. And I was at the other end of the friend group. And so I knew him a little bit in college, but then he left. But in 2000, that group of friends got together for, you know, the millennium, let's party. And we all got together out in California, and Joe and I kind of like, we had our paths would cross in Chicago all the time, but we became really good friends again at that point. And so I asked him, you know, I was kind of away from entertainment for a while, you know, like really fun kind of performance for a while. And I asked him, I'm like, man, I really want to get into some comedy stuff. You got any recommendations? I'm also interested in directing and writing. Got any recommendations? And he was like, well, I'm artistic director of comedy sports. Come take some classes here, get back into it.
So Improv Shakespeare, what I find so fascinating about your show is when people come in from out of town and they want to see an improv show, I always send them to Improv Shakespeare because I know it's going to be a great show. And it appeals to a mainstream audience. Why do you think it's been so successful to a mainstream audience?
I think that a lot of long form can be a little bit like inside baseball, like watching, like the more you know about it, the more you can appreciate it. So a lot of the audiences for long form are students and other people that do long form. Cause you can, when people are really good at it, it might not be that accessible to a regular audience. They don't understand what's so great about this tag out. I'm just confused what just happened. So sometimes I think a lot of long form can be for other improvisers, whereas our show is very accessible because it tells a single story. People know that. They watch TV. They're used to episodic television or whatever. They understand the arc of a story. It's got we meet these characters. It comes to some kind of satisfying end. Either they get married, everybody gets married, or everyone gets killed, or some combination of that. And that's, you know, that's very Shakespearean. The comedies, everyone gets married. The tragedies, everyone dies. So, and in the histories, everyone, you find out how someone became king and then killed everybody. So we really adhere to those those tenets of Shakespeare, and I think people understand it. And then we also are a super goofy group of improvisers that love making each other laugh. And so they love watching the joy on stage. They love watching the play. So if you're an intellectual, you get your fix of Shakespeare. And if you're a goofball, you get to see a bunch of people being goofballs.
Over the 15 years, what is one highlight from an improv Shakespeare show?
Well, there's a lot of highlights.
We've got a couple. We've got time.
one that kind of immediately jumps out in my mind is due to extenuating circumstances, just three of us could do the show. And if I remember the title, it was like Doritos versus Funyuns. And it became like a Romeo and Juliet tale. And it was just the three of us for an hour and a half doing basically a Romeo and Juliet. And it was really exciting because that was the first time we had done a three-person show. It was a ball. It was me, Rich Prouty, and Martin Wilson. So that was a real highlight, just that we were able to pull off something, and it was a very successful show, and it was videoed, and so there's a video of it somewhere. It's super fun. We've gotten to play some really cool places, so it's always fun to like get onto a stage. Like we do the Illinois Shakespeare Festival every year, and we'll go down there and play on one of their sets, and so it's really fun to play, and they have like three or four levels to it, so you can run around and like, I don't know, it's a very theatrical show anyway. And then when we get to play in a space that is also very theatrical and kind of made up, it's just super fun.
When I started this podcast, I had a couple people from the cast at the time. It was Joey Bland and I'm drawing a blank.
Was it Ross Bryant?
Right, Ross Bryant.
And we
improvised a scene. It was very, very difficult to do it in that style. How hard is it to improvise in a Shakespearean style?
I guess it's like anything where it's that it requires a lot of coordination of things. So at first it's really, really hard. But after a while it gets much easier. So I would say the language, of course, is a little tricky, but like Ross Bryant is so unconscious. Like he's so great at it. And Joey Bland is such a master of the poetry of it. Like I can't do what they do. And so like Ross is such an incredible like rhymer and he was the first guy to really master the prologues. And I just can't rhyme like he can. Like I can string together six, but I can't go on all day the way he can. Or the way Joey can see the metaphor of and play with a metaphor for 20 minutes. Like I that's not my wheelhouse. I'm really good at doing goofy characters and funny walks and, you know, so I stay in my lane. You know, I can dabble in the other aspects, but I'd say you find some aspects of Shakespeare that you are really good at, and you know, you master those and it gets much easier to play.
So you're also a professor at Columbia College, the writing and performing program, where you teach improv, stand-up, and sketch. Now, when you're improv, teaching improv, you say that you practice something that Michael Gelman told you, which is we are creating theater when it comes to improv. Why is that important?
I love the aspect of like world making. And so, and the idea that the only limitation is your imagination. And so you can ride a horse if that's what the scene calls for, and you make that horse, you make the audience see the horse. You can have a campfire, you make the audience see that campfire. And I love this idea. I was doing a show really early on with MCTD, and
which was the place in
my
Columbus.
My original team in Columbus. We built that company so much, and we were on the road so much that we had a second team that would fill in for us when we were on the road, because we had like four nights to fill by the time I was leaving. But so the MC Squared was our sister troupe that would kind of fill in for us, and one of us would stay home and just kind of give them notes and stuff. And one time they were doing a show, and I was in the audience watching, and there was this kid in the audience too, like sitting near me, and he kept talking, you know, he was like observing things in the show that he really liked. And they had set up a campfire on stage. They'd set up a campfire and they made it really real for this kid. And then later in the scene, one of the actors walked into where the fire was on stage. And the little kid was like, he's walking in the fire. But of course the actor is not, you know, acting like he's walked into a fire, and the kid was really disappointed. And that was a great lesson to me, is like that object permanence for that kid. They'd spent so much time creating that fire on stage that for that kid was really disappointed and taken out of it when that fire was no longer there. And that was a great lesson to me. Like, we need that object permanence, like see the plot of the land in your head, see the map in your head, and honor it, because the audience sees it and they want that. They want, that's what makes it magical for them. That's what makes it theater, is when they start to see these environments and they're there, you transport them into some other place.
So what do you say to the student? And I get it a lot. I'm not good at object work. How do you make them comfortable with creating an environment?
Well, you play with it, you drill it. And I think, you know, what's important to you as a teacher starts becoming important, because you're looking for it and you remind them of it. And hopefully some of that sticks. I mean, not everyone needs to be good at object work, but I think if you value it, you practice it. And so, like, if I teach it in class, so I have a lot of different ways that I will play with it, but it's always funny if students come to see me perform, I try to remember, what did we do in class? So I can really hit that object work hard today, or I can really hit emotional value hard today.
So you don't have to go back to class and go, you told us to do that and you weren't doing that.
Right.
That's always
do what I say, not as I do.
Right.
Yeah. So hopefully, yeah. So I think, you know, you just practice it, and, you know, not everything is going to stick with the student. So what they end up valuing, hopefully you've exposed them to a lot of different things that, you know, like you not being great at object work, you're still a great improviser. You're still famous improviser. So like, that is one quality that, you know, I like it. I think it's fun. It's a tool, but it's not the whole toolkit, right? So there are a lot of other tools that are make you a good improviser.
And then you also say, in teaching improv, emotions are our friend. Can you explain?
Yeah. So one thing that drives me nuts watching improvisers when I'm watching a show is, so I was watching some students perform, and this scene was taking place in a Home Depot, and somebody was like, oh, they see some toilets on display. They decide to use the toilet, and so they start peeing in it. And the worker, like in real life, you can never find a worker at Home Depot, but but that this worker comes up, the other person in the scene, and they're like, "May I help you, sir?" Like, you don't see that guy peeing in the toilet. Like, you aren't gonna react to that. You aren't having, you're gonna feel some kind of way about that. And then the guy turns toward the worker and pees on the worker. And he's like, oh, he has no emotional reaction to it. He's so disconnected from it. And I think a lot of times, like, beginning improvisers are a little bit like somebody on the spectrum, where they only know what they know. They don't really read what's going on your face. They don't have an emotional reaction. They only experience their own emotions.
But this is with beginning improvisers.
And so when we start reacting to things, we're going to have an emotion to it. Emotions, and then your scene partner is going to have a reaction to your emotional reaction. And it builds on itself. So it's, you know, it's a way of working with yes and. Like, I am taking what you're doing and I'm adding information. And part of that information is my emotional reaction. And that's fun for the audience to watch. They want to see you feel something. They want to be there with you. That's where the empathy comes from. They want to feel what you feel. So feel something.
And I find that when you do that, when I can tap into emotions, it the words come out so much easier. I'm not a focus about being clever and funny and witty.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's really important to that you don't have to constantly invent stuff when you are having an emotional reaction. You just discover how you feel about it, and that will drive a lot. The environment, you don't have to invent a lot of stuff in the environment. If you know that you're in a garage, what's in a garage?
So a tire, a rake, a battery.
And you probably feel differently about the tire than you do about the rake. You know, if you pick up the tire, your hands are going to get filthy, right? It's just dirty. If you pick up a rake, it might, what do you remember about raking? I used to hate that as a kid. And so I feel differently about yard work now. It's like, I have my own house. I kind of enjoy it. But so that either way, if I remember like how I felt about rake when I was a kid, I can have an emotional reaction to this object. If I think about, oh, I'm going to go out in the yard and just be by myself away from everybody for, you know, 45 minutes. You know, it's a much different reaction.
You had another exercise, which I found fascinating, about slowing down the action. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this is this exercise. So you start a scene. Okay, let's say it's a couple at home. They just made oatmeal and they're going to serve it. The wife is going to serve it to the husband, for example. And so she says, here's your oatmeal. It's very lumpy.
Okay, so I'll do that and you break it down. So here's your oatmeal. It's very lumpy.
He said, here's my oatmeal. It's very lumpy in a very confrontational way. That makes me feel threatened. I'm going to push the oatmeal aside. I'm going to just have toast. So now you would say, oh, he said he's just going to have toast, but you also want to kind of interpret what did I mean by what I said?
Just have toast. Okay. I would say I feel scared that we're going to get into a fight. Uh-huh. So.
And then what are you going to do about it?
Well, you know what? Let me make you the toast.
So you would say, I'm going to make new toast. I'm going to make him some toast.
Okay.
And then you don't necessarily have to say, I'm going to make you toast.
Okay.
You can be like, okay, everything's great. Everything's fine.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So,
right.
So it's the key is you're going to give yourself an action to do. And then you're going to say a line. What action? What activity, what bit of object work, what thing are you going to do? I'm going to hug my scene partner.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
It's okay, bud.
Okay.
I'll get you the toast. Whatever. So you would just want to attach an action to it. So it's, what did they say? You're interpreting what they said. How do I feel about it? You're interpreting your own feelings. Mm-hmm. You're giving yourself a feeling, a specific emotional state, and then you're gonna give yourself an action, and then you get to speak. So there's two parts of this, there's two layers to this. There's the performance aspect, and then there's the internal aspect.
Right.
So in the performance aspect, you'll just give me a line, I'll interpret it, I'll give myself an emotional value to it, and then I'll say what action I'm going to do. and then I'll give you a line. So then I'll switch back into performance mode.
Okay. All right. So it's like an internal monologue that you're having. Exactly. And it's, all right, we're two brothers, and it's your birthday. All right. Great. Phil, happy birthday.
He said happy birthday to me. I am overjoyed. I am going to cut the biggest piece of cake. Here, you take the first bite.
That makes me feel really happy. I am going to I'm gonna take the first bite, and then I'm going to hug you.
And then you say a line.
I love you. And I'm so happy for you.
He said he loves me for the very first time, and that he's happy for me. I am so happy. I am going to shed tears. Wow, Bill. That's the first time you've ever said those words to me. And I've always looked up to you.
Now I'm feeling a little emotional, and I'm feeling a little.
So be sure to reiterate what I just said.
Okay.
And then go on to your emotion.
Okay. That you've always looked up to me. And that makes me feel a little weepy, and I'm gonna give you a pat on the back. Thank you. We've never been this honest in our whole lives.
He said we've never. He thanked me and then said we've never been this honest in our whole lives. And I feel like he is seeing me for the first time. And I'm going to pat him on the back. I'm going to pat him back, but a little bit harder than he patted me. Oh, Bill, you're the best big brother a guy could have.
So he said the best big brother I ever had, and he hit me really hard, and that physically hurt. And I'm feeling a little more uncomfortable, and so I'm actually going to I'm going to leave the room, but I'm going to make an excuse because I don't want to hurt his feelings. I didn't tell you this, but Carol just called, and she needs help with Betsy.
He just told me that Carol just called and that she needs help with Betsy, and he was looking very sheepish. It's one of his typical bullshit excuses. That makes my heart break. And so I'm going to drown myself and my feelings in cake. So now I cut myself a bigger piece of cake.
See.
That's cool.
What were you going to say?
That's cool. That's okay. Cool, man.
Okay. That seems, so tell me what that
okay.
Does.
So that's phase one to the exercise. So we only got like, I don't know, maybe seven lines into the scene. Mm-hmm. It took a couple minutes.
Yeah.
So we then speed it up. The next round would be, you will do that all internally, you'll pause in between lines and go through that three-step process. Okay. What did they say? How do I feel about it? What am I going to do about it? And it's really easy to see if they skip, if the student skips one of those steps. And you try and side coach them into doing all three of the steps, honestly, each time. Because often they'll just say something and they'll never do an action. So, you know, they skipped what action step they're going to take. They won't have an emotional response. So, you know, they skip the emotion, whatever.
It almost seems like you're rewiring your brain here.
It is. It forces you to have emotion, and it forces you to take an action. So if you're an improviser that doesn't like to do actions, all of a sudden now you're starting to find all kinds of stuff in the space. You're starting to do stuff. You're an improviser that doesn't have emotional responses. All of a sudden you're starting to respond emotionally. And here's the thing. So those first steps, 1 and 2, are in class. You start doing it silently. And then the homework is that you just do it whenever you think of it in life for the next week. So you start interacting with, you know, your wife or your husband or your loved one or your roommate or whatever. You start interacting with them, but you're going through these steps. And it really does change how it actually is like an exercise in mindfulness. So you start really hearing what they're saying and thinking about it. And then thinking about how you feel about what has just been said. And it starts becoming kind of second nature. And it really does. If you really practice it, it really will change how you improvise. And it might even change how you live your life. So it can be a powerful exercise.
Wow. But there's not too many expectations on that, is there? You're setting the bar really high.
Well, sometimes I'll even set up that exercise as, I'm going to teach you something that is going to change your life and make a big deal of it.
Let's talk a second about, you're African American, mm-hmm. and you've been in the Chicago improv community for a long time. And I'm sure when you started, it was very white. It's less white now.
It's come a long way.
Can you tell us how was it difficult for you at the beginning?
Well, when I was in my first improv troupe back in the day, my brother was also one of the original members, and you know the comedy community was pretty mixed in Columbus in terms of people that were ahead of us, and so I got used to it being very mixed. When I came to Chicago, that was not the case at all. And when I was in Improvised Shakespeare, it was a little bit more mixed at the very beginning than everyone of color left. I took classes at Second City, and there was one other black person that I knew over there, and no Hispanics, no Asians that I knew anyway. I think Claudia Wallace was on stage, the generals. His name is escaping me at the moment. Great improviser, hilarious dude. They were both on main stage at the time, and so I kind of looked up to them, but I didn't know them. But there were very few people of color around, and I couldn't figure out why. But also, you know, like at Comedy Sports, it was not necessarily that comfortable being one of the only black people, because there were just two of us at that time in an ensemble of 50 or whatever it was. And every once in a while, there would be something said that's like, Jesus. Like one time, the director at the time, this is after Joe left, but the director at the time called me out in rehearsal for playing too many black characters. He said, I notice you play a lot of black characters. It's like, I said, I notice you play a lot of white characters. Like, what the fuck are you trying to tell me? Like, it really bothered me. And he didn't even know that he had said something wrong. So I'm glad that that has eased a lot. Now I feel like there are so many people of color, and I've been lucky that I've gotten to work with a lot of people and coach a lot of, you know, like before I started teaching full time, I used to coach a lot around Chicago, and like Chris Red generation, he brought all kinds of people with three-peat. And yeah. before three-peat, like he would get me to coach his teams, and then it felt like a big influx. I don't want to say Chris brought everybody, but sort of coincided around the time that Chris was there, and he was really good at organizing and getting people together and had me coach. So, you know, so that was, it was really great that I saw that influx of people, and even pre-3-peat.
Well, how do you think we can increase diversity in improv?
Well, certainly you can't shame people for doing black characters. I mean, you have to be open to the idea that not everyone behaves like you. And actually you have to kind of celebrate that. Like, I feel like we are all, especially like the older improvisers, we're all kind of gatekeepers to what's happening. And so you kind of not only have to actively invite people to play, but also encourage them to stay. And that comes in a lot of ways and a lot of different layers. Cause I do feel like a lot of my friends, a lot of people that I've spoken to, feel all those microaggressions, and, you know, it's not inviting to stay. It's not fun to play on a team with all white people, you know, or, I mean, it's fun. It can be fun. But frequently something just comes up and, man, it's like, man, why do I have to deal with this? Because I think of improv as like recess, you know, why do I have to deal with this on the playground? Like, I just want to have fun, and that takes the fun out of it for me. And so I think there's a lot of work people need to do on themselves to even realize that they are, you know, that those microaggressions exist. But I do feel like we've come a long way, because people are much more interested in the conversation than they were 10 years ago. Like, it was my imagination in 2008 that when I would say stuff like, hey, there's no black people here because it's not fun to be here. That was my imagination. Now people realize that it's a real thing. And I think that they are actively trying to rectify it. And it's going to take time. It's going to be slow.
What do you tell the student that is in your class that makes the inappropriate initiation, or does an offensive character?
I feel like it doesn't come up as much as it used to. I think people are much more either guarded, like you were saying, more politically correct, or also more aware and a little bit more woke, that it doesn't come up as much as it used to. So thankfully, I think in that regard, it's going in the right direction. Sometimes people get offended for other people. And so the way I've tried to deal with that in classes is like, if you're on stage at any time, you can call a timeout. If something is happening that you're not comfortable with, we'll call a timeout. We'll talk about it. I can call a timeout. We'll just talk about the moment. If you're in the audience, if you're the other people in the class, you can only call a timeout after the scene is over. And that has prevented sometimes where people dip their toe into something offensive and then find their way out. You know, I don't want people to be offended for other people. I find that pretty condescending. Like, let the person that got offended on stage stop it and fight for themselves. I love the Rachel Mason thing of improv is not an excuse for date rape. And so you have the right to stop it, to like, no one, it's not yes and. Yes and is to the world that we're creating. It's not to whatever behavior you want to put on to me. And in class, you always have the right to stop a scene. I think that helps in like talking about it. Sometimes things come up and they won't bother me or my sensibilities, but they bother other people. And so, you know, I have to accept that I'm not necessarily right in all cases. I'll give an example of that. So I was still teaching at Second City at the time, and there was an older guy, probably my age now, in the class, and a couple of the females in the class complained that, you know, that it was creepy. His behavior was creepy, and I did not see it. I did not see it. But I had to, you know, acknowledge it, like, so now I'm going to have to look for it. So, and once I started looking for it, I could see what they were talking about. I didn't think that his behavior was actually creepy. I just think he was an older guy and they were, you know, 20 something year old women, and they were uncomfortable with the imagination of being his girlfriend or being, you know, on a date together or whatever scenario would come up. But I also did talk to him about the types of initiations that might be more comfortable for everybody. So, you know, I put it in his ear. I tried to accept their feeling. And like I said, maybe I have a bit of a blind spot there because I didn't see the behavior the way that they saw it. But I have to trust that their feeling may be correct. And I don't know. And I don't know better. So I have to acknowledge where I am. I have to acknowledge where they are. So I think if everybody honors each other, we have a much better chance of getting through these confusing times. Now, some things are really super overt. But like what that guy was doing, not to me.
Yeah, I had a very similar situation when I was teaching at Second City that you just spoke about.
Yeah. So I think you try to help everybody get through it. But because I didn't see it, didn't mean that it wasn't real for you know, other people.
Lately, I certainly have felt this, you know, we've got COVID-19, we have protesting in the street. It's very emotional on a lot of levels. And then you're like, oh, I got to go teach improv online. How are you getting through it?
Well, luckily, I am done teaching for the semester. But you know, other things have come up along the way. I do think it's important to acknowledge it.
Acknowledge what?
What's acknowledge what's happening in the world.
Okay.
And then remind everyone that we are here for a joyful experience. So no matter what it is from the outside world, we come into this space for fun and the joy of improv and to experience this thing together. So, you know, acknowledge what's happening and then transition to being here, being present in this room right now, which means a lot of leaving whatever it is outside. If you're struggling in another class, you just failed a midterm or something, like you might be able to use that in your improv, but that cannot be the focus of what's happening in this room. So if it's small, something more, you know, smaller like that. But when it's huge like this, I might take the whole class to talk about what's happening here in historical context, at least what I know about it. What do you know about it? Let's share what's happening here and how you feel about it. When Trump got elected, a lot of my coworkers spent the entire day trying to figure that out. I spent maybe 10 minutes, but there were, to my surprise, there were some, because it was a liberal arts, it's Columbia. I was surprised that there were some Trump supporters, and I didn't want it to go in a negative way. So I thought it was more important to go on with class and, you know, like crying over this or getting into arguments over this in class didn't seem helpful to me. But I do think you have to acknowledge what's happening outside. But I find this joyful. I find this to be joyful work. So let's play and have fun and escape that for a little while.
We've got to wrap this up. This has been just great, Rick. We always end the podcast with the same question, which is, what piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
I do think it's important to find a way to make a living from your art form. So break the Chicago paradigm and find a way to get paid for this art form. And that doesn't mean selling out. Find ways, because it's a great art form, find ways to monetize it so that you're compensated for your time.
I want to challenge you on this because I agree with you 100%. A lot of people who listen to the podcast are, you know, they're doing it because they came later in life and they're having fun. Tell me why it's important to monetize improv.
I think that if you were a painter and you love painting, there are all kinds of levels of painting. Like, you can paint just for yourself and hang it in your house. You can paint it for your friends and, you know, maybe they'll hang it in their house. But to me, to pursue, because I always wanted to be a professional performer, and most of my students want that, I think it becomes very important to work toward the goal of making a living doing the work that you love and enjoy. That doesn't mean everyone, like I currently coach a team, and they range from like 35 to 82 is the team. They're very, and they are having a ball. They are having a ball doing improv. Now for them, they don't need to monetize this. Just have a ball doing it. It's fun. I love it, and it's fun. But if your ambition is to pursue this work professionally, then do it professionally. Even if that's $3, you know, charging $3 for the show. Get something, do something, make your bus fare, whatever, get something out of this. I really don't love the paradigm of pay to play, that it feels a lot pay to play here in Chicago. And so I think it is important to find ways to not just pay to take classes and pay to take classes so that you can get onto a stage and then pay to hang out, you know. Find ways to make this a thing where you get paid for your time. Because I think there is value to what people are bringing to the stages. And I think people value it. I think audiences value it. And they don't mind showing that value in terms of paying you for it.
Well, Rick Walker, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Well, thank you for having me, Jimmy.
And to me, you're a real example of doing that. You know, I think a lot of people think, I've got to be on Saturday Night Live, or I have to get a sitcom, or I have to write for a late night TV show to make it in improv. You've made it in improv. I mean, you're a professor at Columbia College. Improv Shakespeare gets paid. I mean, there's a lot of, would you say there's a lot of opportunities in improv that people haven't even thought of?
Sure. I think there's probably something that could be happening online right now that you could find a way to monetize it. You'd have to figure out what that format is. I think it's probably some kind of talk show, kind of whatever. I don't know what it is. I haven't figured it out, and I've been trying to figure it out for a little while. But just doing bar prov somewhere and getting people to come see it and finding a niche. Finding your own style and doing it a little bit differently than everybody else. I mean, it's part of the thing. What is your point of view? Is there anything you want to say? Figuring those things out and casting out lines, try to get some people to bite.
Think, because for me, it is important to get paid. It's and there's a respect to it. But also, do you think that you are a better performer and a better improviser because you're a professional when you get paid?
I think something that my first troupe figured out as we started touring more and more is, like, the more when we would play like the Cleveland Hilarities, where they were charging like $17 or $22 a ticket, which to me at the time seemed like so much money. You know, we were charging $3 in Columbus for whatever, or $5.
And they were another improv group out of Cleveland.
That was a big comedy club in Cleveland.
Okay.
It was a huge comedy club called Hilarities. And they were charging a lot more than what we were used to, but those audiences were more receptive than any audiences we had ever played for. And what we've kind of decided, I don't know if this is true, but there's probably diminishing returns on this theory, but the more you pay, the more you appreciate what's happening on stage. So those people that were paying to me, that was top dollar back then, they seemed to appreciate what was happening more than the, you know, they sort of like wanted to enjoy it to that $18 level or whatever they were being charged. And those $3 tickets were like, I want to enjoy it $3 worth. So it felt like they appreciated it more. But I also think there's the thing of like a professional athlete plays better to a full crowd that's rooting for them. Like there's something that happens to your concentration. There's something that happens to your soul when you've got a full house and they're all rooting for you. And it makes you play better, I think.
Well, Rick Walker, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd. There you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Rick Walker, and my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. And Lauren Corain. She is the head of the interns and associate producer, and she edits the questions. For more information about my award-winning Artist Low Comedy classes and workshops online, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. And follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd and like us on Facebook because it really helps with my low self-esteem. And thank you so much for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run. There is a nerd.